Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to the Rational Face Podcast.
The best podcast on the Blabbernacle.
That's right. I got Tate here helping me out. Today, the podcast is our presentation that Thomas Hatton, Ben Knoll, and myself prepared and delivered at Sunstone Kirtland. We had a lot of visual aids that we used for our presentation. We had a PowerPoint slide, and I've provided those as a PDF file, so you can go to the blog post and listen while you scroll through the files. You'll probably get the gist of it if you just listen, but it'll be a better experience if you look at the actual images that were in our presentation. So I'd encourage you to do that.
Hey, Dad, let's jump right to it.
All right, we're going to start up, so let's have everybody sit down. And then also, just as a reminder for anybody, go ahead and take out your cell phones or turn off any kinds of noise-making devices for the session. And this one is titled Navigating the Landscape of Online Mormonism. And the individuals who are going to be presenting, let me give a little introduction to them. We have Brian, who just ran away, who is the producer of the Rational Faiths podcast. He works as a chemist in Ohio. He got his degrees from Weber State University and the University of Iowa. His interests include religious history and the psychology of religion. He also told me that he doesn't like cats, but except when they're nice. Thomas is going to also be presenting. He is an emeritus permablogger, humorist at Rational Faiths, very prestigious. He works as an outreach coordinator for a community clinic that serves migrant farm workers, refugees, and influences and individuals experiencing homelessness. He is currently pursuing an MA in public policy and administration at the University of Kentucky. His research areas include social policy, immigration, and rhetoric. And then we'll also be hearing from Benjamin Knoll, who's an assistant professor of politics at Center College in Danville, Kentucky, and his degrees are from Utah State University and the University of Iowa. And his interests, research interests, include studying the intersection of race, religion, and American politics. And he is also currently a regular blogger and contributor to the Huffington Post and Rational Faiths. So we'll go ahead and let you guys go.
All right, very good. I'm first up. As I said, my name is Benjamin Nolan. It's good to be here today. Our topic, as it says, is navigating the landscape of online Mormonism. We've each got separate topics, but they all have a theme or a thread of commonality that'll run to them that will hopefully become apparent by the end of the presentation. What I'm going to do is talk about some of the social and political changes that have happened in the United States over the last 50 years or so. Because I think there's a lot of parallels between what's currently happening between the social and political environment and what happens in the online conversations we have regarding Mormonism and our interactions with each other, and specifically how we group ourselves together into different, groups. So what I'm going to do is talk about how this works for politics. As I'm going through, be thinking in your mind, are there parallels here between what's happening between, say, Democrats and Republicans in the United States since the 1950s and what's been going on in Mormonism since the internet has taken off and people find communities online and such? Quick hint, I'm going to argue that, yes, there are some parallels. So see what you can think as we're going through here. All right, first, to set the stage here, go back to, and again, this is me speaking theoretically as I wasn't around at the time, the 1950s. We have, of course, the Republican and the Democratic Party. This is the decade of Dwight D. Eisenhower. Political scientists were very concerned in the 1950s that there was not any meaningful difference between the two major political parties in the United States. Whether you get Eisenhower for president or Adlai Stevenson, they thought their policies are going to be basically the same because there's no meaningful difference between the political parties. fast forward now to what we have in the 2012 and the upcoming 2016 election, suffice it to say, it's safe argument to say that there are some meaningful differences now between Republicans and Democrats. It wasn't so much that there were no differences, but simply rather in the 1950s, we had a situation where there were a lot of liberals and conservatives in the Democratic Party and a lot of liberals and conservatives in the Republican Party. The parties weren't characterized so much by their ideological differences as they were by some other things, including religion, whether someone was a Catholic or Protestant, for instance, predicted if they were a Republican or a Democrat, what region of the country they belonged to. Also, social class was a big deal in the 1950s. So that's the characterization at the time. The 1960s then happened, and there were a lot of things that brought about a lot of social and political upheaval at the time. We had the civil rights movement, we had the rise of feminism, and all these sorts of things. And during the 1960s and 1970s, as a response to those large social upheavals, we started to have the two major political parties in the United States begin to take distinct stands on those issues where before everyone was pretty much in agreement on. In the 1950s, for instance, pretty much everyone was on board in terms of civil rights and feminism and such, in terms of traditional gender roles, segregation and these sorts of things. It wasn't until the 60s and 70s that that started to be a more meaningful political difference. So then through the 1970s, the 1980s, and going on to the 90s and such, we have a gradual shifting and reorientation of the two major political parties in the United States, where there started to be distinct differences between these two political parties on those issues. So now we're at a position where the Democrat and Republican parties are more characterized by disagreement on those issues than they have at any time in the previous century or so. Whereas in the 1950s, whether you were a liberal or conservative didn't really tell you very much whether someone voted Republican or Democrat. Nowadays, it's pretty safe to know if you identify as a liberal, you vote one way. If you identify as a conservative, you vote another way. So what happened to get us between there and there? I want to show you this thing going on. This is from the Pew Research Center. This doesn't go back to the 50s, but it goes back to the early 1990s. This is showing us from 1994, 2004, and 2014. Just pay attention to the top one. Amongst those who are very politically engaged, and then on the bottom, amongst those who are less politically engaged. And then this is showing amongst all the people who self-identify as a Democrat or self-identify as a Republican, where do they place themselves along a political ideological spectrum? We see in the early 90s, we have a differences between the two parties to be sure, but there's a lot of overlap there going in 2004. And then 2014, the last time they did this particular survey, we start to see very little ideological overlap between the two political parties here. Show you this one as well. This is telling us in 1994, you had a place where it says 64% of Republicans were more conservative than the median Democrat. To our 2014, 92% of Republicans describe themselves as more conservative than the median Democrat. And here, amongst Democrats, same thing. We have a position going from 70 to 94% in 2014. So essentially, we see the two major political parties just pulling apart ideologically from where they were, say, in the 50s, because of the things that happened in the 60s and 70s. Okay, so there's that, which happened. Next, getting into our topic of online things, what happened with media choices at the same time? So, 1950s, 1960s, this is before the internet, everyone's watching the same three TV stations. We've got NBC, ABC, and CBS. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican, everyone's getting their news from Walter Cronkite. Everyone is on the same page. We're all looking at the same news and getting our information from the same sources. Sure, we have our political disagreements, but our versions and interpretations of the events that are going on are still fairly similar to one another. Enter the 1980s. Cable TV is invented. We start having news networks, 24/7 news networks that come along that become very, very popular. In the 1980s, for the first time, people are really able to choose their media content, at least for the first time in this last century, based on the preferences and the things that they believe and enjoy. Also, because cable news network is a largely corporate endeavor, we have news stations that begin offering content in such a way as to try to get more viewers based on the kinds of slants that they enjoy in the news there. Then we have the 1990s with the invention of the internet. People start getting on to like listservs and America Online and all those kind of groups and all that kind of stuff, which provided even more choices for individuals to be able to customize and tailor their consumption of news content and such, how they interpret the things that are going on in the country here. Okay, so what do these things have to do with one another? On one hand, we have the partisan sorting going on, and then we also have the news media changes going on. Again, we're going to rewind to the 1950s. Again, we have so much ideological overlap between the parties, in part because everyone's getting their news content, media content, from the same basic sources. That was part of the causal relationship between these things here. As the 1970s and 1980s go on, as the parties start to take the distinct stands on things, being able to sort yourself into different political parties was made that much easier by the availability of different news networks, cable news stations in the 1990s, different websites, different kinds of blogs and places, that it only made it easier for people to kind of isolate themselves off into one particular way of thinking about the world, interpreting one's politics, manifesting one's preferences, and all of these sorts of things. Which leads us to the situation that we're in right now. Let me show you this graphic here. Of course, in standard American politics, we have the blue representing Democrats, red representing Republicans. This is from an analysis that a researcher did of Twitter networks, Twitter activity. This is showing they took for a sample of time and they looked at Twitter accounts that were perceived or that were self-described as being more liberal, Twitter accounts that were self-described as being more conservative. How often are they interacting with, retweeting each other, responding to each other, etc., etc.? The story that this analysis showed is that the liberal and conservative Twitter accounts don't really talk to one another. They're in their own little worlds. Once in a while, there's like a retweet or a mention of someone else's, but for the most part, it's a conversation amongst themselves to each other instead of talking across that partisan divide there. This graphic, same basic thing, except this is looking at blogs instead of Twitter accounts. But it shows the same basic story being told here. In this last decade or so, we're in this position where Republicans talk to other Republicans, Democrats talk to other Democrats, and that's how we do our politics for this last decade or so in terms of our worldviews and such. So we're in a position where we're all able to pretty much tailor, customize our reality that we get from the media to basically tell us the stuff that we like to hear. And that's what we do as Americans. This is our tradition now that we've had for the last decade or so. Okay, so now, what does this little political science lesson have anything to do with online Mormonism? Again, I said at the very beginning that we'll be drawing some parallels between some of these things. Have there been some that perhaps have occurred in our minds as we're as we're going through? Okay, I looked into doing my own Twitter analysis of like the Bloggernacle blogs of all the Mormon-themed blogs. I was not able to do it in the time content. You know, I just that would be a big project. It would take about a summer, and I wasn't able to do it. I'm sorry, but so what I'm offering instead of hard data is my impressions that I strongly suspect are congruent with a lot of these patterns that we tend to see here. In my personal experience, I also tend to perceive the Bloggernacle, as some also describe it, the Blabbernacle for the podcasts and that sort of stuff, as being fairly ideologically sorted into different kinds of camps with not a lot of cross-communication going on. On one hand, we've got we've never really settled on any good labels for them, right? Some people use the Liahona Iron Rod distinction from the Richard Pohl article. We have an Iron Rod, a faithful, confirming, supportive, loyal, and critical kind of discussion about Mormonism going on. And then we've also got a Liahona, questioning, independent, critical, antagonistic at times kind of a camp going on. I suspect if we were to do an analysis, we would see something that very much looks like this in terms of the online blogs that we have going on. Lots of people talking in their own tribes, in their groups and communities, but not necessarily with each other as we're going through. Yes?
I just want to point out, so I'm on one on Facebook called A Thoughtful Faith, which is where people are supposed to be able to, there's like across the spectrum in there, right? Mm-hmm. And they're supposed to be able to discuss those things. But lately it's been an interesting conversation. You're an admin, right? Have they been getting complaints from people that it's too negative or too this or too that? And so it's like they're trying to take it again. And like, you know, at the moment, I feel like we've been able to have a very open conversation across, like it's been more mixed. But you see people trying to make it more separate.
Right, right. Yeah. No, I appreciate you bringing that up there. I can say, so part of this gets into, so why do we do that? Like, what's the psychological basis of us wanting to sort ourselves into these groups here? I argue that the same reason that we do this in our Mormon communities is the same reason that the Democrats and Republicans in the United States have sorted themselves out into their different groups as well. Because we like to have our worldviews and our biases confirmed. It feels good to us. Evolutionary psychologists would say that we have literally evolved a mechanism in our brains that gives us a dopamine hit whenever something we agree with comes into our brain, and we feel really good, and we want more of that because it feels good to feel good. So we seek out those things that make us feel good, and not having our worldview contradicted feels really good to us. Whereas things we disagree with coming into our brains makes us feel discomfort. It gives us cognitive dissonance, and we dislike it, and our brains are motivated to try to fix that as quickly as possible by removing things that don't make sense to us. So we have a situation now where, again, on the political side, we have Democrats and we have Republicans who really don't talk to one another all that much. And we've gotten to a point where, as we're customizing our realities, we're pretty much inhabiting separate worlds there. And it's not just that, but it's gotten to the point here where it's not just that we're sorting ourselves out, but we dislike each other to much greater degrees than we did in the past. This is showing from 1994 to 2014, the amount of Democrats who have a very unfavorable view of the Republican Party. Over two decades, it went from 16 to 38%, and Republicans who have a very unfavorable view of the Democratic Party going from 17 to 43%. Yes.
So, don't you think that maybe, like, if we were to go back in history 100 years, 150 years, we would find the same phenomenon because people are living in a community that's a certain way, and they all talk to each other, and they have opinions inside these small communities.
Mm-hmm.
Just like maybe like in the last session that Speaker was talking about, the difference in opinions of, you know, people who are black, and though, but there's this and that, and, you know, like people have these really polarized opinions, but you might go to another community and people have different opinions. So with the rise of media, are you saying things kind of leveled out a little bit in our world, like in the mid-1950s, and now they have?
So if you take it back even further, so I'm starting everything in the 1950s. Political historians have argued, if you go back to, say, the founding era with, like, the Democratic Republicans and the Federalists, back before we had the professional norm of, like, objectivity in journalism, the media at the time, newspapers, were fairly similar to what we see going on now. There was a pro-Jefferson camp and there was a pro-Adams camp, and they hated each other and they flamed each other just as much as we do on Facebook now, the equivalent of the time with the editorials and such. And that went on for much of the century there. But then with the rise of the progressive movement at the beginning of the 20th century, then we have the rise of professionalism of journalism, the rise of objectivity as a professional norm, and the attempt to get away from that. And so there was that going on, and at the same time, a confluence of factors involving political and social issues led to that congruence that we see in both the media and the political parties, and it's now going back out again. So it wasn't always the way it was in the 50s. It's just that's the way it was for most of the people who are alive today, remember back only to the 40s and 50s, because everyone else is. So for our discourse that we talk, we assume that that's kind of the beginning there. But yeah, go back to the previous century, and it was that bad. Of course, what happened in the 19th century that eventually led to a civil war, which many would argue is not a good outcome, right? So so if we want to have that good, solid, stable community, that's not necessarily a desirable condition to be in, of that extreme self-sorting of worldviews and such that we have there. I'll also show this to you here, along the same lines here. Percent of each political party that see the other as a threat to the nation's well-being. So it's not just in a fear, but it's a sense of delegitimization of the other party here that has been increasing, especially since the 1990s going on till now here. So this is increasing as well. Is there a parallel, say, in Mormon blogger communities and such in terms of being afraid of the other group and seeing them to maybe to some extent as illegitimate and a threat to the well-being of the community? I would argue that there is some of that also going on that has been increasing over time here. So that's my assessment for kind of where online Mormonism is as of 2015. I see this as strongly paralleling what's been going on between the partisan camps in the United States over the last several decades here. So is there good and bad to this? And I'll end on this here. The good side of this is that research has also shown that political participation, like voting, donating, volunteering, all goes up through the roof when people talk to only people who think like them, because it's fun and it feels good and you feel happy. So if your interest, or if your outcome of interest is promoting participation and active engagement, then surrounding people with people who think just like them is actually a pretty good strategy for getting people to do stuff and to participate, which democratic theorists would say that's a good thing, to get people voting and participating and such. And we're happier. It's more fun. It feels good. The downside to that is that it then becomes harder to be open-minded and evaluate the world more critically if we're only exposing ourselves to arguments that back up what we already think. I recall our friend, Brother Quinn, earlier, I liked his quote. He said, both dogmatism and skepticism should remain modest in our understandings of the world and such. It becomes harder to do that if we're only talking to people who think just like us. It also makes it more difficult to overcome the us versus them mindset that's so common in our world today amongst both politics and religion, all that kind of stuff. If we're only around the people who think just like us, it accentuates and exacerbates that us versus them, it's the good and the bad and the black and the white kind of mentality. And my personal belief is that the gospel of Christianity calls us to try to transcend those group boundaries and to try to find unity, in Christ and such. So I'll end on that point and turn the time over to my friends.
Thanks for a wonderful presentation. You could have just continued on. I'm sure everyone would have been happy. So my little bit is about online Mormonism in a nutshell. It's kind of leading into it. I've been sort of a resident of online Mormon homes for a while. So I was born into a family where faith issues were pretty explored and discussed. My dad's side were sixth generation Mormons in Kentucky, which is kind of cool. My mother's side are, I think, six or seven generation Mormons on the Utah side. I'm a relative of Ezra Taft Benson, I kind of couldn't really escape the world that I'm in. From an early age, I remember distinctly the first time, I must have been 8 or 9, when I realized that the views I saw in Star Trek The Next Generation about God, about this founder species, were quite similar to Mormon theology. And we have this seafaring godlike race, spacefaring godlike race that's traveling through the universe propagating its species. I called it the Endless God Dispensary. I learned about things like Blood Atonement, which sounds like a great unreleased Clint Eastwood movie, or a death metal band. And the Adam God theory, things like that, which I thought, well, what if God is just Adam's last name? Then it answers that right there. So all of these things were things that I was exposed to from an early age. It did create some sort of dualism where I would be hearing things at church and I would be hearing things at home. Finding some sort of cognitive dissonance, having to live with the discomfort of cognitive dissonance. But my uncle started a podcast around 2005. Some of you may have heard it, Mormon Stories. I started listening to that early at that time. That's where I sort of was exposed to a lot of the scholarship. Me personally, I was active on a lot of message boards at the time, when there were message boards and not Facebook groups. This presentation is somewhat anecdotal, some research, but just my experience. So a little bit about my personal faith crisis. Like I said, it wasn't like a sudden thing. It was more of like a gradual, and I sort of started as a harmless exploration of different ideas. But then what really hit me, everyone has their thing. Church art is so bizarre. Have you ever actually looked at the Book of Mormon? I mean, let me walk you through it. What the hell is this guy wearing? That's a Roman centurion helmet with Viking horns on it. That thing has got to weigh 100 pounds or more. And then over here, I mean, King Noah, he looks like a giant Keeler elf with a potted plant on his head. And there are leopards. And then I always thought this guy's hat was so cool. I wish Ezra's book would
like Zelda's hat. I don't know if you can see it well, but I think it's a pretty cool hat. It's kind of a hippie hipster. Anyway, so I remember noticing like church art as sort of a thing, and probably one of the most painful realizations was every single figure in the Book of Mormon has a mullet. In all church art. If you've never noticed that before, Moroni has a silver mullet, sort of like a MacGyver sort of alteration thing. Everyone, all of the angels visiting Christ in 35 and Jesus himself all have mullets. Nephi, big muscular figure, not nice Billy Ray Cyrus kind of wet mullet thing going on. So kind of a shocking realization to understand or know that all of these guys had mullets. It brought forth a lot of, I guess, sort of theological questions for me. Will I have a mullet? Will my celestial body have a mullet? Do I have to have a mullet? Can I cut it? Because it doesn't look like anybody else has any sort of variation on that hairstyle. So I remember having a lot of sort of deep theological questions relating to, you know, these bad fashion choices or art choices or hairstyles. So I looked out on the internet. I said, is anyone else concerned about this? And I couldn't find anything. So I created a group called Coming to Terms with the Abundance of Mullets in Church Art and got a modest following in which we sort of looked through all of the different church art. I kind of created a collection of church art and noticed the frequency of mullets, a Tumblr as well. And my first piece for Rational Faith was called Mormons and Mullets, if you'd like to go back and read it. It's sort of a look into the mullet, and it sort of led into a larger criticism of church, the abstract surrealism that is LDS church art. Anyway, I use that as a foil to kind of talk about what a lot of these online communities are like. So we have something, the traditional faith crisis narrative says that we find some unfavorable information that we hadn't been exposed to before and we're really uncomfortable. We don't really feel like on our local level we're able to engage with anybody about it. And so what the, I thought it was really moving that Brother Hammer was talking about yesterday that there was a community, a marginalized community that was able to meet and to provide each other support. The online sphere has given a space for people who are suffering in sort of a private way to gather and to meet and support each other, you know, validate each other's opinions. Like the presentation says, that it provides community validation and support. There's a variety of ways that you can engage with online Mormonism. There are podcasts, some popular ones. I mean, many of you know the podcast Mormon Stories or A Thoughtful Faith or Mormon Matters or Rational Faiths. There are a number of blogs by Common Consent, Times and Seasons, Wheat and Tares, Fair Mormon, No More Strangers, a lot of different types of blogs approaching these kind of questions in different ways. Message boards, I don't think that they use them as frequently now, but message boards have been a thing. You see a lot of engagement on message boards and Facebook groups. I noticed that Facebook groups have kind of taken the place that message boards did, where people are directing each other, engaged in really direct ways. There are some feminist Mormon housewives, Mormon Hub, Mormon transhumanists, Affirmation. Each group or each blog will oftentimes have an equally robust or active presence on Facebook and discussions about different issues. So I feel like any sort of, approach or thing, you know, a difficult topic that you're struggling on, you can find a group of people that can sort of affirm you or validate you or challenge you. So as far as the efficacy of these groups as providing this help, I'll just introduce one thing, and it's called the online disinhibition effect. So you could say there's a lot of positives and a lot of negatives about this engagement in online Mormonism. The online disinhibition effect is basically the phenomenon in which social mores are non-existent in the, or at least less existing or less established in online dialogue. So there are some positives to this online disinhibition effect. People are much more willing to share, to be vulnerable, to share their stories, to engage others in a really deep way. In social mores, you know, often tell us to be disconnected and to, you know, not ask deeply personal questions. But on these boards, people are much more open to share things and to validate each other and to seek out new ways of thinking. The negatives of this online disinhibition effect is a social more would say, you know, if you have a differing opinion, I'm not going to scream in your face or yell or engage you in a super negative way that, you know, everybody would be offended. On the online world, as many of you know, doesn't really have that. There's
all sorts of flame wars that occur. People sort of dehumanize each other and say really hurtful things. Even really reasonable people can get in places where they're saying things that just seem really rude. I said exceeding rudeness in mine. They engage each other with exceeding rudeness. So I think that anecdotally, as a blogger for Rational Face, we all have struggled with tone and perception. So this is kind of from a content creator's point of view. Tone and perception as a content creator is difficult because when you're just trying to do something, it's interesting to view the way you're perceived. Rational Face is about to publish sort of it was a brief survey we did where we talked about how different people view the different major blogs, whether they're more, I guess, favorable to the church or more antagonistic to the church. And we were trying to see what readers in the Blogernacle viewed. And it's really fascinating that there is some consistency. Most people were viewed in the middle, but there are skews that oftentimes didn't really correlate with, like, I guess, the blog's intended effect. So it's kind of one of those things that it's hard to really manage the way that you're perceived in the Blogernacle. So I also went on some Facebook groups and I asked, well, what are some difficulties of living in this online space? And a lot of them sort of affirmed that this is kind of a summation of quotes. Many appreciated the ability to congregate with like-minded individuals and have access to resources and answers to questions. A few remarked on how negativity about the church fed into more negativity, which is not helpful or productive. I've seen in most groups they gain a core of frequent users that become friendly, but there are people who, because the faith idea or the faith transition idea means that people are coming in and coming out as they sort of see fit or need to. So while there's a core community, there's a lot of transients as people come in, want to stay in the church perhaps, and then leave, or, you know, as people say, you know what, this isn't the time that I want to leave, or whatever else. So it's more of a transience around it. So that, so as a podcaster or content creator, we were talking about last night how a lot of these blogs where different things are sort of treating the same topics over and over again, but it's sort of the type of thing that at any point where you come in, people are learning all this information newly each time that, you know, this cycle is continued. So that content will always be fresh to somebody. So anyway, this kind of leads into Brian's conversation about the faith crisis narrative.
As my first slide indicates, my argument is that a faith crisis, I think sometimes it gets downplayed, and I think it really is an identity crisis, and I think that framing is very useful in two ways, in helping us understand why sometimes we're so defensive and reactive within a faith crisis, or why other people in the middle of a faith crisis are reacting that way, but also that it's a normative thing, that we go through identity crises as we grow up. And so it's something that isn't the end of the world because we went through adolescence and other periods like that, and we got through them. So that's my argument. And just a quick little story. I grew up in a family that went into the mountains a lot. We hunted and fished and camped. And my dad was a bow hunter. And when you have little kids, you don't go bow hunting with little kids, but he had to take us anyway. And so we would sit in a camp all by ourselves for hours and hours on end. And I would get, for some reason, I would get really nervous, like, he's going to leave us. I know he has another vehicle somewhere and he's abandoned us. This didn't happen. My father never abandoned me. But I had this fear of being alone. And later, you know, I would go hiking in southern Utah or Wyoming, and if I got in a bad position in one of those places, I would be in dire straits. And this is the human condition, I think, or part of the human condition is we are not meant to be alone. We do well when we're together, and unless we've trained ourselves to survive in the alone wilderness, it's a scary place. And so sometimes we need a vehicle. Maybe it's a Jeep or maybe it's a spaceship to go through a very vulnerable place, like Spaceman Spiff often goes through. But if that vehicle is damaged, then we're going to be stuck on some lonely planet somewhere, and we have to fix our ship in order to move forward. And our ship is our identity. We have to repair our identity in order to move forward. And our identity is something that's very important for us. As I prepared for this, I read a bunch of articles in developmental psychology, one of the names that comes up is Erickson, who was big in this area in establishing it. He said that identity provides us a deep sense of ideological commitment and allows us to know our place in the world, and it gives us purpose and meaning. And so an identity isn't just my name, or it isn't just some of my characteristics. It's who I am. It's how I make sense of the world. It is my beliefs. And that's what makes us able to inhabit this dreary world sometimes. But a faith crisis is an identity disruption. And identity disruption is where our beliefs that we once held are coming into conflict with new information, and they're not agreeing very well. And this is our identity being disrupted, our spaceship is damaged, and it's something that's hard to deal with. And it might be new information, or it might be discrepancy in behavior of someone like an ambassador for the church, a top leader or a local leader or our parents, or even just local members. We see them doing something that we feel like isn't something a Mormon would do. There's a lot of ways that you can come into a faith crisis. So one end of the pole is a rapid or violent faith crisis that we see maybe attributed with reading the CES letter, reading Rough Stone Rolling, or a new atheist speech or something like that. Or maybe there's also another, still a faith crisis, but a slower supported one, and that might be a student of history or a student of Bible scholarship, where they're still exposed to these different ideas that might be vastly different from their experience in church, but they're supported. Maybe even a longtime subscriber of Sunstone or Dialogue might be a similar example. So it's two different ways to have a faith crisis.
When we go and express this online, we're met not with greeting arms necessarily. We have a lot of different responses to our expressions of doubt or faith, and we might be told that we've been reading on anti-Mormon literature, or that we haven't read enough, or that we had the wrong expectations of our faith or our church or whatever it might be. And all of these assertions could very well be true. We could be reading the wrong stuff, or we very well could not have read enough. But as another famous person besides Immanuel Kant said, not everything that is true is helpful, and it might actually be harmful. And for someone in a crisis of faith, I think these sort of responses, depending on how they're said, are not always helpful. And so let's talk a little bit about identity development and what this crisis is. I heard some discussion earlier that the term crisis it's like it's too dramatic or it doesn't describe it right. And the way that Erickson talked about it is that in the developmental sense, it's not a threat of catastrophe, but rather a turning point, a crucial period of increased vulnerability and heightened potential. This is called being a teenager. That is an identity crisis. And so he presents this identity development or this identity crisis as something that we all go through, from going through childhood through adolescence into adulthood, middle age, and then into old age. And all of these crises we pass through with an increased trust in ourselves, an increased sense of good judgment, and that sort of a thing, that it's something that helps us grow. And so with childhood, it starts with toys, actually, or the possessions that a child has. My son's 5 years old, and he's like a raccoon, my wife calls him, because he likes shiny things. And he'll get like my old ID cards or like keys to a bike lock that I don't use anymore, and he collects all this stuff, and he has a blanket and everything. And if that is lost or taken from him, or if he asks for something and he can't has it, he kind of freaks out a little bit. And the reason why is that it feels like they've been betrayed. Their identity is under attack because that is them. Their possessions are part of themselves. And those aren't my children. Mine are much cuter than that, although nothing wrong with those children. But after age six or so, they say they generally enter into this stage where they identify with their parents and the traits of their parents. But beyond that, the adolescence is actually described as a very long period between ages 12 and 24, if I remember right. And so this is called identity formation.
this is where we ask, who am I? What is my place in the world? And I was just thinking for an ideal 24-year-old who's gone through this and formed their Mormon or LDS identity, what are some of the things they believe? They might be, if they were an Eagle Scout, they might be Thrifty Brave Clement reference. They will probably believe in the Bible and the Book of Mormon as God's word. They'll believe that prophets have a special connection with God and they tell us what God wants us to know. They believe that prayer can be answered. These sort of things. And this, I think this happens quite a bit. Many active members, myself included for a time, carried these beliefs, and this was part of my Mormon identity. And I'm sure we could frame identity even more broadly than these, but these are just some examples. But these identity-forming events are not experienced universally in the same way. Reading the Book of Mormon can be really dry, and you might not have very much of a connection at all, or your answer to prayer might not come. Your marriage in the temple might be wonderful, or it might be terrible. There's a lot of variance in each one of these proposed identity-forming events. And so we come to our identity as a Mormon person in unique ways. And like I said before, we come out of that identity through a faith crisis, or we have that identity disrupted in unique ways as well. And some of the ways that I experienced and many other people have experienced and expressed is that this identity disruption is a very much a feeling of being alone, a feeling of questioning whether there is a purpose to your own existence. And you just start to really question everything. It's not just one thing that can be fixed with apologetics or whatever it might be, but it's a very deep introspection into yourself and who you are and how you view the world. And famously, in a New York Times article, Hans Mattson described that he felt the foundation upon which he had built his life began to crumble. He felt, not unlike Spaceman Spiff in a damaged aircraft or spacecraft, that he was falling through air. What this is that we find out that we were wrong, that we didn't understand the world the way that we now understand it, that we didn't understand the church to be the way we had inherited it. And being wrong often feels like exile. It feels like we've been separated from our community, from God, or even from ourselves. So a faith crisis is not simply having your beliefs change. It's really having your beliefs change. It's a serious experience. And so because we have these different ways that we develop our Mormon identity, we deconstruct our Mormon identity, and we reconstruct it, each one of those pathways there has a lot of variability in it. And so there's this very broad spectrum of what someone on the other side of a faith crisis, what their view on the church or God or life is. And that is their new identity. And like the example of my son, they will defend that identity, fighting tooth and claw or tooth and nail or however the phrase goes. And again, it's all about belief, because that's what an identity is. It's a worldview, and a worldview is belief. And when we recognize that we're wrong, or when we recognize that someone is disagreeing with us, this presents itself as a moment of alienation. And when we see others, especially on the other side, or definitely in the throes of a faith crisis, when we see others that disagree with us, we often come to three conclusions. Either they are ignorant of the facts, or if they are not ignorant of the facts, they are incompetent in processing the facts, so therefore they're an idiot. Or they are indeed not ignorant, they are competent, so therefore they must be evil because they disagree with us. And when we're limited, and you can probably think in your mind of responses that people have and arguments online, and you often have these sort of things flung around. But this is really frustrating, because if we just look at people, I mean, all of these are negative. These aren't neutral terms. It doesn't really promote healthy discourse, I don't think. And it also shows, if that's how we view people that are different, that disagree with us, there's no way that we're going to throw that stuff at ourselves. We're going to find every way to justify that we are correct. And beyond that, in the previous session, Misha talked a little bit about this granting of ourselves complexity and giving others simplicity. And it's like looking at an iceberg. Often in psychology. It's called the illusion of asymmetric insight, where others, we see just the tip of the iceberg. We see just a caricature of who they really are and what their how their thoughts have led them to the conclusions that they've arrived at. But within ourselves, we see these deep thoughts, and we see these existential crises that we've gone through and reasons why we've come to the conclusions that we have. But we don't grant that to others. And so it's just more of this reason why it's so hard to communicate with others, because it's hard to see inside another person's mind and really feel their experience. So in the end, I think online communications, like Thomas said, has pleasures and pains. We can find people that are like us, that affirm who we are and how we think and how the world really works. But at the same time, communication is always really hard. And I'll just reiterate, viewing faith crisis as an identity crisis and not a catastrophe in the developmental sense, we can see that as a normal part of adult development. But also, it helps us understand why we offer such strong defenses and arguments at times, and why others don't accept our view readily. Thank you. Well, folks, I hope that presentation was enjoyable for you. I enjoyed presenting with Ben and Thomas, but more enjoyable than that is today. Now, you might listen to this later, but the day that we're finally putting this together and releasing it is a very special day. What is today?
Halloween!
Yes, it's Halloween! So happy, happy Halloween, everybody. Whether you got this on Halloween or later, have a good one. And until next time,
keep keeping it weird.